You know what? Let's start here because and I was actually thinking like I might post the last 40 plus minutes of this very interesting chat as a bonus to see how we got finally through all that to where I think is like a pretty ripe starting point if you got the time to talk about the topic at hand, which is something I've noticed personally, something I've seen you tweet about Fred, and I've seen a lot of people. It's just pervasive, and it's a sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but it's a loss of motivation. It's a loss of energy that seems pervasive across America, and I sense it in everyone. There's almost no exception to this in my life. And you know, today I sent you an article. It was printed in the New York Times about this notion of Stucktopia, about our culture reflecting this subjective feeling that we're all experiencing, which is that we're stuck in time. We're stuck. We're stuck in the rat race. We're stuck in this maze, but we don't know what the meaning or purpose of any of it is. And there's just, it's an enervating time. And I know you've mentioned it. And so, yeah, I know you've independently thought about this. So one, could you briefly describe who you are, because I think people are it's interesting because you're one of the, no offense to your profession, Fred, but you're one of the few Asian American studies professors, in addition to political science, I guess, is your specialty, that I find really interesting. I think there's a lot of bullshit in the Asian American studies space. No offense to your peers, but I always found your account super interesting.
No offense taken. And I would only add two things. One, there's a lot of bullshit in the political science space as well.
Sure.
There's a lot of bullshit in academia. I don't think Asian American studies is particularly bad. I also don't know if it's particularly good. Sorry, to actually answer the question, I'm Fred Lee. I'm a associate professor of political science and Asian/Asian American studies at the University of Connecticut. Most of my training was in political science. I really didn't start doing anything Asian American related until I got to UConn. And I kind of found myself in these circles, and I was invited to basically move half of my appointment into the Asian/Asian American Studies Institute.
I see, gotcha.
And you know, when the line transfers, you get in a different circle, you get in different networks, and you actually start being exposed to a different set of literatures. So my actual background is it's in political theory, so sometimes called political philosophy. And it was very much European intellectual history. You know, if I'm going to be real about this, I was a Europeanist. That's what I was trained in. English, French, and German political theory. And it really wasn't until, you know, I was on the tenure track and working as a professor that I started looking into things like, what does Asian American studies have to say about political theory? Or what does East Asian sci-fi have to do with imagining the future, you know, and this kind of thing. So that's who I am, at least professionally. And I'm also a Twitter addict. I'm on there all the time. Yeah. I'm tweeting. I've got 6,000 tweets at this point.
Yeah.
It really started when I found myself stuck in the apartment during the pandemic, you know, and I wasn't feeling particularly productive. I think we were all kind of feeling this burnout that you were just talking about, Teen.
Yeah.
And this became a way of distracting myself, learning about different conversations. So yeah, very pleased to be on this pod. I've been following Plan A for some years now and following you for about the same amount of time.
Great.
So, but yeah, going back to this Stucktopia idea.
Yeah.
So this is, it's an op-ed in the guest essay in the New York Times today. Welcome to Stucktopia. Really interesting. Really interesting because, in sci-fi, so yeah, we were just talking a little bit about the apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic and pre-apocalyptic and all that. So
the fixation in popular culture on the apocalypse, right? Like it seems like
exactly
this some apocalyptic event. It doesn't matter whether it's a nuclear war or a zombie virus outbreak or whatever,
right?
But it is heavy in our imagination right now, for sure.
Absolutely, world-ending.
Yeah,
world-ending event. So that's one area within sci-fi, speculative fiction, fantasy, you know, it's just kind of an area. But the other area, and this is what I think Stucktopia is playing on, it's utopia and dystopia. And these were, there were many variations on these ideas, you know, during the Cold War. A lot of the idea is, you know, don't go for communism because you think you're going to achieve a utopia. And what you're actually going to end up with is this totalitarian dystopia. Okay. And prior to that, you know, there were utopian socialists. There were socialists who were basically saying that this utopia, this good place, which is also no place, that's the dual meaning of utopia, this is coming down the line. This is the better and brighter future that we're actually fighting for and striving for and so forth. Okay, so both utopia and dystopia for me are actually about moving somewhere, going somewhere. The idea that the future, whether better in the utopian case or nightmare in the dystopian case, is somehow going to be fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so what's actually really intriguing about this Stucktopia, and that just means stuck place, the topia just means place, is it's this idea that we're not going anywhere. We're stuck in this sort of
right
system or machine. You know, there's all sorts of imagery around this: subterranean offices, M.C. Escher-like prisons, spiraling deep, spiraling mile-deep underground complexes. I'm just reading out of the essay.
Yeah, yep.
But we're stuck. We don't get it. And it's totally meaningless. Okay, and so this has got to have something to do with the sort of lack of motivation. Because if you don't actually think you're working for something or working towards something, or that there's any point to this work life at all, or maybe even just life at all, it doesn't seem particularly motivating. It doesn't seem rational to be like striving and doing this kind of like seize the day kind of stuff.
Let me ask you a question. So, I've noticed as an outsider, sure, someone who only casually follows, you know, political philosophy or whatever, I mean, you know, Twitter level, right? I have noticed that there is a real connection between psychology / psychoanalysis and political theory. And I didn't ever really quite understood why. Like, if you look at, you know, like the Frankfurt School, right? Like they were interested in both these sort of like macro political topics, as well as these sort of like micro individual subject type topics, right? Am I noticing something here? Is that right? Do you see a connection?
I mean, I definitely see the connection in the Frankfurt School, which is not strictly speaking political theory, you know, just because I think they were all across the board, You know, yeah. Some of them were in philosophy, some of them were in sociology, some of them were in psychology. So in terms of disciplines, they were like very interdisciplinary. But if we do look at what they were saying in sort of strict political theory terms, yeah, their big question was, or one of their big questions was, why fascism?
Right, exactly.
And this is on everyone's mind right now.
Yeah. And they, because, and I feel like there's, you can approach that, you can approach that question both from a macro, like what are the economic underpinnings, yes, or the precursor or the economic conditions that, that in history lead to fascism or something like that.
Yes.
But they were also looking, and I think very, in a very interesting way, and something that I personally find very interesting since I'm, we're living of this time and we are subjects, is,
yeah,
what is the fascist personality? Like, what's the kind of personality that you find either during or in the lead up to a right, sort of fascist revolution, right? Or a, maybe not a revolution, but a conversion over to fascism. And I'm not particular, I don't think I'm particularly concerned about fascism in the United States. I know there are fascists in the United States. I just don't think that, I just don't think that we're going to end up like a Nazi Germany. Like, we don't have that kind of energy.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we do have, I mean, sorry. So, first point, that's exactly right. The argument about the Freud-Marx mashup that the Frankfurt School took as their central project claimed you have to look at both the objective or the structural and the macro historical side, which for Marxists had to do with capitalist society and trying to get beyond it. You know, socialism and communism eventually, according to the, you know, according to the linear interpretation of Marxist theory, and there are some people who utterly reject it, but you know, there were some who believed in this kind of, there were stages you had to go through. Okay. So that was the sort of macro historical. But their interest in the micro historical or the inner life, the personality and psychology had exactly to do with trying to sketch out character types that would interface with or be the kind of subjects that acted in these broader macro historical situations. Mm-hmm. So their big question is, okay, if according to Marxist theory, capitalism keeps undergoing crises and eventually more and more people, let's call them the workers, the proletariat, are going to wake up to the fact that this system is in permanent crisis and has to be done away with in favor of a different political economy. Okay, if that's what Marxism says, why is it that we see in the most severe economic crises that the actual temptation is towards fascism? Why is it the fascist character type, this so-called authoritarian personality, seems to take over in this sort of dictator mass movement dynamic? So that's one way of understanding, you know, one of the earliest books in the Frankfurt School. Theodore Adorno led a research team around this, the authoritarian personality.
Yeah.
So the critics of the Frankfurt School have always said basically what they were trying to do is explain why the historical rationality of Marxism, which drives towards socialism and then communism, didn't pan out. Mm. And so they had to kind of bring in this psychoanalysis supplement to explain why people's basic tendencies are not rational, irrational, tend towards cruelty, why they fear freedom, why they crave submission, why they really take quite a bit of pleasure in inflicting pain on outgroups or whatever you want to call them, you know, be they Jews, communists, Roma, etc., black people. Okay. So the criticism of that has always been, well, you just kind of jury-rigged an excuse so you could save the Marxist commitments. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I do see some truth to that. But the general link within political theory basically goes down way back to Plato, Socrates, all this, where they basically, sorry, these ancient Mediterranean, ancient Greek philosophers were basically saying every kind of society has a characteristic type of person. Mm. And the type of person who is most representative of that society. So really this kind of like authoritarian society with the authoritarian leader and the authoritarian mass, this has very ancient roots in whatever the Western tradition. Because what Plato, Socrates, and them were saying is, you know, there's a particular democratic personality in a democratic city. In an oligarchical city, there's an oligarchical personality, all that. So I think that's where it's coming in. The psychoanalysis thing, that was a sort of contingency of the 20th century. And the same with the Marx psychoanalysis mashup.
Okay. Right? That's very interesting. The reason I'm going down this path is...
Yeah.
Because, and this is, I've been thinking about this more and more, is that the nature of the like modern America, like the contemporary right now, as of today, right? The nature of the American subject is something that we don't really seem interested in. We don't really seem interested in ourselves at this point, because I think. Maybe we're almost taking it for as an axiomatic part of modern liberalism is that there is no such thing as an American subject. We're all individuals. We're all unique. And so it's pointless to even think about the world in those terms. But that's why I was surprised that the Stucktopia thing was printed. It was one of the few articles that I've seen printed in, you know, like a guest essay, as you put it, printed in the in a place like the New York Times, that sort of took it for granted that we're all kind of experiencing a common subjectivity in this place and in this time. Whereas most of the time, it's just sort of like assumed or stated that we're all unique. We're all different. It's a pluralistic society. We define our own subjectivity. Mm. It's a matter of our own personal history. It's a matter of our own personal preferences and experiences. And so we wouldn't talk about that stuff. And then I'm starting to see like, okay, maybe we're starting to get to the point where we're putting the focus back on our sort of, is there such thing as being an American, like an American of today, and what kind of personality is that? And I think that's really important, though. It seems like we don't really want to talk about it, but one of the things that I think is driving this, maybe like hopefully a surge in interest in this, is that we're all fucking tired and we're all fucking burned out and everyone's feeling it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I've never experienced this before, but today I had my boss came over to my desk. And she was just talking about how badly she just wants to quit this fucking job. And she's like, and what her plans are. And then we start, and then we literally think about this. My boss and I are sitting there talking about what are the viable ways to escape this sort of permanent employment trap? Like, you know, is it maybe we become independent contractors and just work part of the year or stuff like that? And I'm like, I've never talk to a boss about this kind of stuff. You know, you're not supposed to say these things, but there I am, you know, talking about it. And that's just one example of a really severe shift, I think, away from, and we had been talking about this before, Byung-Chul Han's notion of the achievement society, which is marked by sort of like this almost toxic positivity and this almost inner mandate to achieve the achievement subject. I almost feel like his really insightful and wonderful take on that is almost outdated. I think we, the burnout society may have finally burned out. You know what I mean? I don't know what your, if you have any similar experience. I know you've said you've noticed that in your students, and you've noticed this. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed in the faculty, but like, what do you see
in sort of cost benefit analysis and return on investment terms? Students were paying more and more for their tuitions and less certain about having a stable lifestyle, a well-paying job on the other end. Okay, so there are many factors. So that's what I'm seeing on the student side of things. On the faculty side of things, yeah, there's a whole cottage industry about advising faculty on how to leave academia.
Wow.
Usually by faculty who have resigned, retired early, and just, you know, gotten the fuck out.
Yeah.
And then they advise others on how you too can escape the academic dystopia or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So this kind of escape idea, I think it's across the board. And there's a feeling among the faculty that, well, a couple things. One, that we're being asked to do more and more work. You know, for example, turning on a dime to converting a class into an online class. Working with students whose education has been interrupted by the pandemic to get basic writing, essay crafting, this kind of skills, you know, get them up to speed. Meeting with, you know, students who are often legitimately distraught over real personal problems and the fact that our social infrastructure is falling apart and the like. So that's one feeling, that we're doing more and being asked to do more with no corresponding raise in pay. Another thing I think we're feeling is the work we are doing, the more work we are doing, is not particularly gratifying or particularly meaningful, that a lot of this work seems like, you know, what David Graeber used to call bullshit work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of my constant complaints on social media, that we hardly have time to do real work because we're being piled up with so much bullshit work that seems utterly unnecessary. So just a quick example. The paperwork process for me to propose a new class, to design a syllabus with 20 different requirements that have been imposed by our university bureaucracy, to get it through the committee structure so that's approved and put on the books, I don't see any of that as necessary, and I'm not going to do it. What I'm going to do is keep teaching my class as a one-off so I can avoid all that paperwork. You see what I'm saying? Like, yeah. But it would take dozens of hours of time to get the actual syllabus approved through the standard procedure. So that's just, you know, one example. Okay, so that's another piece of it. So we don't see the reward in terms of, you know, financial incentives to work hard. And the other part is, much of the work we're doing doesn't seem inherently valuable or socially useful at all. It seems to be part of, you know, some large and personal machine and being imposed from above, and we don't even have any say over our own classes anymore. Okay, so I think those are two reasons for the burnout. I'm not sure what to make of this Han Byung-chul argument about burnout society. I think it's super interesting, and I think he is super interesting. And for any of the Planet Escape from Plan A listeners who haven't checked out his book, it's an important one. It's called The Burnout Society. It's only 50 pages. It's really just a long essay.
And pretty accessible. It's written in philosophical, you know,
Yeah.
Grammar and diction, but it's quite readable, I found. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I agree. I think the basic thesis that we don't live in a repressive society, that we don't live in a society where people are should do this, should not do that. We don't live in a society where there are prohibitions, and then if you don't follow the rules, you get punished. I'm not so sure about that. So one of the things Han is trying to argue is that the capitalist societies of previous days, that's over and done with. Because now we live in a society without negativity, is his philosophical way of putting it, but it basically means no prohibitions, no punishments, no refusals, that kind of thing. So he says we have an achievement society where everything is positive and there's no sort of antagonism. There's no, I'm not going to do that. There's no, I'm going to overthrow this social order. There's no rebellion, that kind of thing. Instead, the burnout society, or the subject of the burnout society, is obsessed with achieving things for its own sake. Who knows why? No real kind of critical reflection, because that's negativity, right? I refuse this. This is stupid. This is, you know, we need a better alternative. And because they are sort of existing just to achieve, just to produce, just to work until they drop dead, this is totally unsustainable. And they are driven by this inner compulsion to basically be, you know, this is the old Radiohead line, fitter, happier, more productive.
Yeah.
So his idea is we don't need repression because we're exploiting ourselves. He calls this auto-exploitation. And I'm saying, I think he has captured something very true about a kind of top 10% of the income distribution. I'm not sure how far it applies. You know, like, does the 1% operate like this? But I think, you know, Teen, you're in law, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. So in your profession, my profession, academia, maybe the medical profession, maybe the publishing industry, the cultural industry, I do think that this idea of auto-exploitation is very powerful explanation of how this class strata operates. And I think that's where a lot, I mean, you don't know how many conversations I've had in the hall where, you know, you just ask, how are you doing? And you mean it as a pleasantry, right? Like, nobody really wants an answer. Mm-hmm. Like, and then the other person or you yourself start saying, I am just tired. I'm frustrated. I can't believe this or that BS. Okay. So I do think he's pointed to something real, but I'm not sure it is characteristic of the entire society. Like, I'm not sure, for example, that the Starbucks workers and Amazon workers who are on strike were so driven to self-exploit. Does that make sense? I think they
still have the
experience of what Han calls allo-exploitation. In other words, less pretentiously, being exploited by another and having a grievance and saying no to that. Does that make sense?
It does, though. When I had a similar... And this is why I enjoyed the book so much, because as I was reading it and he's talking about this auto-exploitation, you know, I was skeptical of the way he formulated that up until he brought up Nietzsche, because I was thinking exactly of Nietzsche when he was saying this, because I think there's a difference, a real difference, between obsession with or compulsion versus self-exploitation, right? So I would say compulsion means that you feel compelled, you feel a desire to do the thing that you're supposed to be you're supposed to be doing, you know, whatever it is, right? Achieve. Versus auto exploitation, which is you've internalized the allo exploitative authority. You've internalized the authority. Now you still fucking hate getting up, and you still fucking hate having to do all this shit, and you don't feel actually compelled to do it in the sense of it's an inner compulsion. This is what I want to do. I want to achieve.
Right, right.
You still feel that there's an authority figure external to yourself commanding you to do it, obligating you to do it, and your feeling is that of obligation rather than compulsion. And I think Han does draw this distinction in the book, and I think to that degree, I think he's correct. I think he's correct in that we are all being told to be our own taskmaster, which is different than we are all feeling compelled to achieve. And I think that's what he's saying. And I think that that's right. And I do think that that's fairly pervasive if you look at the cultural program. Like, the thing that unites us in let's say, in America is we all are sort of fans of the same degenerate popular culture. And I think we derive a lot of our personality tics from that culture. And that culture doesn't really care whether we're top 10% or top 1% or bottom half or whatever. It kind of just talks to us all at the same time. Have you noticed that popular culture really modulate based on class? It's sort of a one-size-fits-all popular culture. And everyone's into the same shit. And let's say poorer people feel like this is authentically their culture, whereas richer people think, I would like to drape myself in the authenticity of this sort of degenerate culture because it's maybe what we would call a vulgar culture, and that means that it's more of the people, and I want to be of the people. You know, I'm going to dress in a hoodie even though I'm a millionaire. And I'm going to listen to the same music, and I'm going to watch the same TV shows, and I'm going to be on social media with the rest of the country, with the rest of the hoi polloi, and I'm going to adopt the same cultural tics as them. And so I do think that there is something pervasive here beyond just law and medicine and stuff. I think that there is something in our culture which uses social status. I think social status is a big part of this, to create, to sort of offload central authority into the sort of like super ego authority of each individual. We do it to ourselves. I think that's what he's saying. And I think that burnout is the point at which we fail to advance to that sort of third phase of Nietzschean, if that's the way to say it, Nietzschean evolution, where you are going from obligated to compel it, to compelled, inner compulsion, right? This is what I want to do. It doesn't burn me out because that's all I really want to do. And I think burnout society, I've interpreted that to mean the failure of the system that we've set up to get people to that point. And so ultimately you fail because you can only work off obligation, especially internal obligation, to the point where you're just totally exhausted. And like a mule, you just decide at some point you say, fuck it. You know, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do it anymore. Does that make sense?
This is an interesting question. How the Nietzsche bit, works, because I know Han prefers Nietzsche to Freud, because when he's talking about the lack of prohibition and repression, he's basically saying that was a part of the old society where there was negativity, and now we have a society of pure positivity.
I got the feeling he was not saying that that obligation disappeared, but that it relocated to inside the individual, whereas it used to be coming from a sort of extra, like you said, allo-exploitation. It was coming from a centralized authority outside of yourself that you could put distance between you.
So I'm not sure what I'd have to go back to Han and like read it more closely. But what you're saying, Teen, your thesis or your interpretation of what Han's saying,
my interpretation
is very Nietzschean.
Yes,
it's very Nietzschean.
Yeah,
because what Nietzsche basically says is the subject is formed by internalizing certain forms of cruelty that he maybe in previous times in these sort of medieval festivals of cruelty, he would have enacted on other people. And therefore, kind of in this inward turn, directs the cruelty against himself, which is Nietzsche's interpretation of what he calls guilt or bad conscience. And so that is precisely an obligation that instead of an external force, a king or a priest or your parents or something, telling you have to do this, you are saying, I have to do this, I must achieve, I must exploit myself, and right. I've become, in your terms, in your words, my own taskmaster. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm thinking about it, yes, that is what Han said about Nietzsche's idea of the sovereign individual, which for Han is not a good term. Sovereign individual is just this, you're going to boss yourself till you burn out. Okay. So now this brings us to the class question, because, okay, the question of how far this sort of strike wave that started around the pandemic can be generalized to people who work in the service industry, for example, that's an open question. We also had huge academic strikes, especially on graduate students who, you know, they're saying we have no future. You know, there are no tenure track jobs and so forth. You're running the university into the ground. Okay, so how far that can be used to generalize across the entire society or national culture? I think that's a great question. But I do see your point, which I take to be, we have more and more claimed that our freedom consists in being our own taskmaster. And this hooks into capitalism because, you know, the idea that you are self-responsible for your fate, you know, if you don't make the money and don't have anything to eat, that's tough luck, that's your fault. Okay, so that's one piece of it. And then the other side of it is just the sort of political theory correlate of liberalism, which, you know, as you rightly pointed out, has no idea of culture, has no idea of history, has no idea of development. Well, it does have ideas of development towards liberal society. But if you see what I'm saying, like all that stuff you were saying about Russia and China reasserting its cultural and historical traditions, that's what liberalism is telling you to leave behind.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Of course.
And so in that sense, I do think burnout society may be intensifying and sort of dialing it up on these liberal capitalist tendencies of how you're supposed to be a person, how you're supposed to be a self. Okay, so that's on the one side. On the other side, I do think it's interesting insofar as Americans do admit of having a national culture. It's not differentiated in the way that, you know, feudal societies differentiated between high and low culture, right? The people who can read and have books, and people who usually can't read and have oral cultures. You know, that's vast overgeneralization, but that's a lot of Eurasian societies had. Mm-hmm. A lot of Eurasian societies were formed around that principle. As you said, we have more of a mass society than a class society insofar as consuming culture goes. And the mass society, and this is going back to Frankfurt School stuff, says, you know, a billionaire like Donald Trump is going to eat McDonald's just like everyone else, and Bill Clinton is going to go onto their Arsenio Hall show and play smooth jazz. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, of course I do.
You're Gen X, so I think we have a lot of common mass cultural references. And that's a mass society. That's a mass society. And if in a mass society you say, actually, you know, Han Byung-chul or Nietzsche is a deeper thinker than what are these guys? I'm trying to – it's escaping me. The people on Twitter, the big intellectuals on Twitter, You're a snob. You're saying something undemocratic. You're saying something elitist, hierarchical, and so forth. So I think I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but what I'm saying is that's an attitude of a mass society. And I think the room for opposition and room for maneuver is kind of limited. And I think this is also part of what Han is saying about the sort of burnout society. It's hard. There's hardly any spaces of resistance. There's hardly any spaces of reflection. There's hardly any spaces where people are trying to build up alternatives. It's actually kind of, now that I think about it, it's kind of like he's saying this is a totalizing mass phenomenon. Correct. It doesn't matter what class
if you're your own taskmaster, how are you going to rebel against yourself?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
But so, I think, but let me ask you this, because I read what I read the work as a whole to suggest is that there is no possibility, as you said, of, you can't organize against self-repression. You can't, the whole point of it is that you can't organize against it because it's not external. There's nothing to rebel against except yourself. And so here's what I'm wondering, Fred, is the generalized loss of energy and motivation, is that how it ends? Which is, instead of a revolution, it's a burnout.
Yeah.
Instead of organizing against the man, we burn out and give up against our own goals and our own, you know, stated ambitions. We give up on it. Is it a mass giving up at a personal, subjective level? And so, and I've long wondered if that's actually the most dangerous thing that people could do to threaten the system of internalized self-obligation is. Yeah. We all just fucking burn out one by one. We all just sort of give up one by one. And I wonder if that's, quote, the new revolutionary thing to do is to just give up. That's the only thing I can see to work these days is like, just let the system wither and stop giving it, lending it, donating your energy to it. Just give up. And pretty soon, I think we're going to look at the whole Gary Vaynerchuk and all that hyper motivation culture that found its, you know, it got started with, you know, the coked up 80s of the Wall Street era. And then it found its way into the startup world of Silicon Valley, and it was based there, and it's super coked up or drugged up or whatever the fuck they're doing out there. And I think
what is the name again? Sorry, I haven't heard of this.
Gary Vaynerchuk? Gary V?
Yeah.
Gary V is this guy on YouTube or what, he's an influencer with like a lot of followers. And he's all about, you know, getting up at 4 a.m., fucking working out until, you know, you're about to pass out, and then 6 a.m., go take a shower, get to the office by 7:30. Basically, like, you know, you've got to do, like, if you want your life to mean anything, you've got to do this. You know, if only 1% can achieve it, but you've got to see, are you that 1%? You know, it's a whole,
right.
It is the distillation to me of achievement society. It finds its most obscene expression in someone like Gary V, V-E-E. You can watch his videos and you know, see for yourself. And he's not a dumb guy. Here's the thing. They're not stupid people. I mean, they're astute people, and they know how to talk to people. It's because they're salesmen, you know? What am I trying to get at? I'm asking you, I guess. Do you see that connection at all? I guess I'm seeing that the failure. Look, I think that the very publicized unionization of an Amazon distribution center in Staten Island is neither here nor there. The unionization of a few Starbucks is neither here nor there. It's not. I don't really think that there was like a bona fide. I don't think that there's a growing labor movement in the United States. Partially because I don't think that there's actually labor in the traditional organizable sense that we used to have, right? Like, we don't have an industrial base. So
we don't have industrial proletariat, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have an industrial proletariat, so it's not the same. I think almost the notion of labor organization is kind of, in my opinion, I know that'll probably piss a lot of people off, but I just don't think it really is the force or the threat, I would say, that it used to be. I mean, just look at South Korea right now. That's a threat, I would say. More of a threat. Mm. But I think that our threat, because I do believe in the overall observation of achievement society and the internalization of oppression, is that burnout rather than revolution is sort of the radical end to this. And that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In people. So I do tend to agree that one, Han himself doesn't seem to leave a lot of room for the standard revolutionary project of self-conscious, sort of self-determination, self-directed, here's a program and let's implement it. Let's transform society in the way that we want. I don't think he has any room for that. I don't think that's his overall vibe. I don't think that he really considers that a likely possibility of the burnout society, because as you've pointed out, if this kind of society is going anywhere, it would seem towards what we, in popular culture call collapse or post-apocalypse or, just ends with a whimper, not a bang, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think the sense of burnout is more widespread than even the desire to take great risk, professional and personal, in the attempt to build up worker power, build up student power, this sort of let's get organized and build our own power base. I think that's right. Will it always stay this way? I mean, sorry, let me erase that. Now, does that mean that no revolutionary change can happen? I'm not sure. And the reason I say that is poli-sci people claim that in order to get major reforms, at least, this is not revolution, really you just need 3.5% of the population to be very motivated to get a certain set of reforms passed.
Is that a historically informed kind of idea that's looked at?
It's
historical revolutions, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's statistical analysis. The political scientist who has written about this most extensively is Erica Chenoweth. Erica Chenoweth, 3.5% rule is how you would search for this on Google. And so the idea is you don't actually need 95% of the population, because even if they are burnt out, apathetic, have their sort of, there is no alternative, and we're just going to work ourselves to death, etc., that doesn't necessarily preclude an organized group. And, you know, is it left? Is it right? Is it socialist? Is it fascist? I think these are all open questions from basically trying to govern the entire society. Is that a likely possibility? Not in my view, but, you know, I don't have a professional opinion on it. That's just kind of my gut feeling. I do understand your skepticism around some of the protest movements, strikes, you know, the encampments at universities, Starbucks workers strikes, and so forth. And I think the real problem for those advocating for revolutionary changes, or who even just think that revolution is something we should seriously be discussing, I think the real problem is which force or which alliance of forces would actually be the ones to bring it about. That doesn't seem clear. And another thing that doesn't seem clear is what the actual model is going to be like.
Yeah,
like,
what are
they
going to
be
exactly?
A sort of January 6th insurrection? Is it going to be more of a sort of, you know, what's going on in Detroit with people who are in the sort of lineage of James and Grace Lee Boggs, one of my graduate students, Lily Law, who's actually written a great piece in Plan A magazine about Afrofuturism and techno-orientalism and like, you know, she would say, you know, people are actually trying to bring about localized cultural as well as economic change around, you know, growing their own food and, you know, becoming self-sufficient because they know they can't rely on the state or the market, you know. So I do think there are, I guess we'd call them oppositional cultures to the mass culture. But yeah, the whole point of the mass culture is it includes most. So that's my take. You were saying something?
Yeah, let me, here's the other thing, right? About okay. My skepticism is okay, if you can get enough people to form, you know, a serious insurrection of a political insurrection of sort. Well, what's your platform? What are you going to do with all that revolutionary fervor? Are you going to implement, for example, Medicare for all? If you do that, you're going to get us to Canada. We're going to revolutionize America into Canada or to the UK. If we socialize education, we're going to turn into Germany or what? Are these really radically different societies? They're just kins. They're kins to us, right? So
yeah,
I'm not even sure that if you could muster revolution, like what we would consider like sort of an outsized revolutionary, a positive revolutionary energy, which is more of this positivity that Han is saying surrounds us and is the problem, that even your revolutionary ideals are positive, right? But look at the world today. Look at the reality of it. What is the most, if you're someone who's heavily invested in the system as it exists today, the system of power and wealth, what keeps you up at night? Things like the fertility rate, things like the office vacancy rate, and the absolutely cratering value of office real estate around the country, right? Mm-hmm. These are not vague threats. These are existential threats that's actually putting the fear of God into the current established ruling elite. And So it's not a vague sense. It's an ongoing, we're fucked sense. Have you noticed how freaked out they are about low fertility rates? They look at South Korea with horror. They look at what's going on there in Singapore and a lot of East Asia, and they're they're looking at it's happening in Europe. And it is happening in the U.S., though we're offsetting it with immigration, which is creating its own other kind of crisis, right? So I would say if you look at the actual phenomenon going around the world that is really threatening the system in a truly radical and truly destabilizing way, you know what it is? It's not any action that we're doing. It's the lack of action. It's the lack of activity. It's people saying, you know what? I don't really want to do the commute anymore. I think I just want to work from home. That's destroying our economy, right? That's destroying our cities. That's destroying real estate prices. It's people saying, you know what? College is really expensive. And, you know, I'm just not really meeting, like, you know, I'm doing app dating and I'm not really meeting really a lot of serious, you know, potential here. So I think I'm just going to stay single and live on my own. And
Right.
That, you know, that is, if you galvanize people into that kind of dropout mentality, which is what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And the fertility rate is dropping like a fucking rock because of this, right? That in sum total, in my opinion, is the kind of burnout that at scale is truly threatening, and they don't have any answers.
Right.
Whereas,
so
Amazon seeing the unionization of one of its centers in Staten Island, I don't really think that makes them fearful. And in fact, I think in a way, they actually I'm not saying that it's a plant, but I'm saying that they exaggerate the degree to which it's a threat, because I don't really think they're that threatened by this stuff.
I would agree that the ruling elite, ruling class, is much more concerned about fertility rates and population replacement than worker or student rebellions. I agree with that. And the reason is they're afraid that the economy is going to shrink. And so it really messes with their bottom line, because if the point of your economy is to grow and keep growing and grow without limit and without end, yes, what you're afraid of is the economy is going to shrink. You're afraid that your age structure is going to be really top heavy towards the old, towards older people who don't have kids, and all the later generations are going to have to, you know, not be as productive as they could because they're taking care of the parents, or who knows. Okay, so I agree with that. So what are the elites worried about? No doubt what they're really worried about is a shrinking economy, which is the opposite of what they want, which is growth. And it could very well be that you know, the pattern we've seen in post-industrial societies, Japan, Korea, United States, Western Europe, is much more threatening to their hold on power. Now, I don't disagree with you, but I would point out this. Every revolutionary project has a notion here about crisis, and somehow the crisis shifts both the opportunity structure as well as what kinds of risks people are willing to take. In other words, maybe the actual mechanism for generating the severe crisis to the point where everybody realizes that the system is just falling apart by all of its conceivable metrics. You know, one metric here is economic growth, but you could very well think of crises of like people just fighting on the street and getting killed and just, you know, other things that, you know, the system is supposed to prevent from happening. Okay, so it fails by its own criteria. Okay, and everyone realizes this. I guess the point on behalf of trying to actually direct what comes next has always been, yes, people are not going to they're going to stay stuck in what they know, in their old routines, in risk-averse behavior, in trying to survive in a very competitive and ruthless environment where, you know, the middle class is getting pushed into the lower middle class and where it's harder and harder to have social mobility and so forth. So that could be the mechanism. That could be the mechanism. It doesn't
what
mean,
what are you saying
however,
could be the mechanism?
That,
sorry, clarify that sorry. For me. What are you saying could
sorry,
be
the mechanism could be the system fails to deliver what it promises, which is growth, for example, or fails to provide survival because of ecological disaster, you know, something like that. So, sorry. And it actually doesn't matter what the mechanism is, but those are two possibilities. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I guess what I'm saying is people have gotten unstuck. And there is a whole era that basically stretched from the French, Haitian, and American revolutions into the 20th century communist revolutions. Vietnam, China, Cuba, etc., that showed that when people were desperate and things were falling apart, at least a small amount of people tried to lead the entire society to a different kind of society. I guess that's what I'm saying. And I'm not saying I'm looking forward to that. I'm not saying it's an inevitability. I guess what I'm saying is it's a possibility. If the burnout does go far enough, the crisis could be severe enough, that may actually change.
Well,
may actually get us unstuck.
Well, I'm offering maybe a more optimistic view, right? Which is that if you interpret, if at least how I interpreted this concept of burnout society is that we don't need to get to that point. We don't need to get to the point of subsistence, you know, going down to bare subsistence level and lower before we're willing to force change. And I think one of the biggest burdens of those who seek change through positive revolutionary means, one of the biggest burdens is what the hell are you asking for? What authority are you seeking to overthrow? The Haitians had the advantage of the French colonizers being the obvious ones to overthrow, right? Like, we know what to do. Mm-hmm. We need to kill those bastards and we're done, right? We stop being slaves and we've accomplished our goals. It's very clear. But in the achievement society, the modern achievement society, it's not clear. And I think his point is that the authority that you want to overthrow has hidden into, it's burrowed itself into each of our minds. And so, the modern subject, which has been removed from the flow of history, has been removed from, we don't exist in the same plane as these revolutionary precedents. So, you know, I hear people say this all the time. They're saying, hey, you know, this is what happened with the Bolsheviks. This is what happened in China. This is what happened in Haiti. But we're not those places. And I think that the attempt to graft those conditions into the modern contemporary American era, it just feels, and I think everyone knows this, right? That's a Hail Mary pass. You know, it doesn't translate. But what I think does translate is one, I think I disagree with your idea that the ruling elite want to deliver growth. One, I don't think they care. They just want to get wealthier. That doesn't require growth. That just requires them to take more of the pie, right? Which is the Piketty analysis of capital, right? They don't really care about growth. They just care about their share of the overall social wealth, right? As long as that's growing, it feels like growth. It's equivalent for them, right?
Okay.
So I don't really care about delivering growth. Two is I don't think that it's just about the failure of the system to deliver on growth and deliver on progress. I think it's also for the ruling elite, you know, when we were talking about the distinguishing between the libidinal and the political, I feel like there is a libidinal economy to what the ruling elite care about. It's not just the system functioning as they promised or as they wish, because I don't even think that they really care. They're not dependent on that anyway, right? But I do think that a lot of this has to do with the loss of their sense of purpose, mission, identity, even. If people are not worshiping them as the exemplars of our culture, of our achievement culture. Because if I'm a billionaire and I'm a self-made billionaire, in the achievement society, I exist as a god. You know, everything I say is of great value. People form fan clubs around me. You know, like Elon Musk, he walks around like a sage upon the earth. And I think that is more meaningful, and they're more scared of losing that. And if you listen to, you know, what some of these people are saying about, and they're fixated, by the way, they're absolutely fixated on work from home and how that's destroying the country and fertility rate and how people aren't having kids. They're absolutely terrified.
Right.
And I don't think it's because they need those as economic inputs. I think it's that it really strips them and threatens their libidinal identity, their subjective feeling of having worth, power, exceptional, and being exceptional.
Yeah.
I think those are very powerful drivers that I think are underestimated in terms of what's going on. You know what I mean?
Well, I think there are two things here. So, it's in general good to not have a sort of one-sided view of economic production as everything. And I think what you're pointing out with the elite's status as culture heroes, which is not directly productive, except maybe it is indirectly, because, you know, prestige of a ruling class is kind of a thing. But that they could very well be invested in their social status and their purported non-economic values to the society, you know, like being a Steve Jobs, Elon Musk thing. That is the sort of high-tech burnout society culture hero, you know, a rich guy who like is so driven and who achieves and so forth, whether they do or not. But, you know, that's the sort of mythology around it. So I definitely think you're right to distinguish between that kind of motivation and the motivation about not being able to take a larger piece of the economic pie. I could accept an amendment that they don't really care about growth, but what they care about is taking the lion's share of whatever growth does occur, or just the lion's share of whatever wealth there happens to be. And that would along the lines of the status achievement goal, that it's really just about being a status symbol and being of a certain upper class strata. Even if you are culturally the same and consume all the same mass societal commodities. So I can generally accept all that. I also think that burnout society, I hear what you're suggesting. You're saying that instead of doing what the left and also the right now basically calls organizing or mass mobilizing or finding participants for some kind of project of transformation. What you're suggesting is that the more radical thing, precisely because it speaks more to larger segments of the population, as well as requires nothing but people continuing to try and achieve, and instead of achieving, just burning out, right? So it doesn't, you know, it's not like any big ask. People actually just keep just doing what they're doing and undermine themselves and undermine the entire society. So yeah, I think that may well be it. You know, in these other theories of crisis, you know, the standard Marxist one is the rate of profit continues to fall, and therefore you have to exploit the workers even harder to try and bring it back up. But then the workers wake up, see the exploitative dynamic, get organized, and you know the story, right? Communist Manifesto stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. I completely agree. Sorry, let me just say this, and then I'll hand it back. I completely agree that model is a part of the 19th and 20th century segment of the, you know, revolutionary tradition or whatever you want to call it. Okay. And so that played to the socialist and later the anti-colonial revolutionaries that leaned socialist the same role that the idea of creating a constitution played for the Haitian and the French and the Americans. The constitutional thing was like huge, like, you know what I mean? Like that was like the real innovation of that earlier generation of revolutions. And so fully agree. And again, there's no guarantees, but if people actually try and reorganize society, if only for the reason that everyone is burned out and it cannot function the way it used to, I guess that's what I keep emphasizing. Like, what comes next? I think that's where, if we have any hopes about self-directed transformations, that's where it is. Like, it's in the next, because if subjectivity took on a certain cast during the achievement society, I don't think any subjectivity can be fully fixed, because in my view, cultural, psychological, and subjective change happens all the time. And if you take a long view of, you know, human history, you know, humans before the first agricultural revolution, so-called, very different than after that first settled agriculture happened, before the Industrial Revolution, psychologies, subjectivities, cultures, very different than after the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, so I do get what you're saying, that part of what the achievement society does is sort of make a rebellious subject, a revolutionary subject, much harder to even imagine. But I also think that when societies basically, for objective reasons, can't go on that cultures, psychologies, and subjects will basically have to adapt. I guess that's what. Now, will it adapt for the worse? I mean, you know, it could very well, be going towards some kind of. I think fascism is not the best term, for the reasons you pointed out. History doesn't repeat; it rhymes. But if something more like an authoritarian direction happens, that's well within the realm of possibility as well. So I'm not, I'm not saying all revolution is a great thing. I guess that's just my perspective. Sorry, team, I cut you off.
Oh no, that was great. And we're at 2 hours. I've taken a lot of your time. By the way, if you're interested, I think we should continue these because I find this really quite helpful in just organizing my thoughts, like just bouncing it off your thoughts and stuff.
Absolutely.
A lot.
No, I've enjoyed this conversation quite a bit, so happy to follow up.
Yeah, but I guess my final thought here is that Han sort of inspired me to think about stuff completely in terms of not, okay, we've got this sort of like ruling central, ruling authority that has great influence and control over everything. And now we've got this heroic band of left wing activists who see a better future, but they don't have any support. They're grassroots. How do they muster the will and the methods to go against all odds and revolutionize the system of oppression that we all live in? Han completely subverts this concept and says the system of oppression lives in your own head, right?
Yeah.
You're your own oppressor. And so if you want to get out of oppression, right, just stop oppressing yourself and just drop out. Just drop out. And I think the net result of that, and I see that happening, and I think he's almost predicting that that's going to happen, because there's a fundamental limit to how much of this, of this intermediate phase of human development. I think that means that we're stuck in an intermediate phase of development. We actually don't become true sovereigns, right? We become these hyper conscientious dilettantes, right? Not sovereigns. And eventually that leads to burnout, because that's not really what you want, right? You're telling yourself you want that, and then yourself isn't convinced, but it's obligated, and so you burn out. But here's the thing, is that that kind of spells an end to the system. And what I think is interesting is that that alleviates the revolutionary subject, let's call it, which is the dropout. Mm-hmm. It alleviates the dropout from having to come up with an alternative system, because really they're calling the bluff. What they're saying is, I think in mass, is to the true sovereigns of the system, the people who are not oppressing themselves into achievement, but are truly sovereign achievers, right? They're the megalomaniacs in our system, the ones that happily get up at 4 a.m., work out, and just achieve max the entire day, and that's in their blood.
Yeah.
Right, and that brings them no stress. That's their joy. That the dropout calls their bluff and says, you know what? We're going to have a better system, and you're going to come up. It's on your ass to come up with what's going to save your life, because I'm fine dropping out. I don't give a shit anymore. I'm out. And I think that leaves the elite scrambling for answers, because they don't want to lose us. They need us, right? This is the closest thing I can think of to what on the left they call a general strike.
I think.
I mean, maybe they don't come up with anything, but then they lose.
What
them.
Basically? So, yeah, no. I think what you're proposing is something like reconstitution. Sorry, this is jargon, but. Reconstitution of hegemony. That's basically what you're saying. You're saying that it takes two to tango. There's elite and then there's mass. And we don't have to say it any more specifically than that. But if the mass starts to drop out, the elite will be forced to come up with new conditions of status, rule, wealth, etc., as a compromise for those who are no longer performing their achievement society role.
Yes.
And okay, so for me, that's not. I mean, I guess what I would say is that preserves the basic structure of the society. So in that sense, it's not a revolutionary possibility. I guess it would be if somehow the dropout, burnouts, etc., either got rid of the elites or started coming up with their own proposals. I mean, that's the more conventional understanding of right. what a revolutionary change would be. I think the other thing, and this will be my last thought.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is very Nietzschean, because what Nietzsche is saying is the so-called sovereign individual is actually a pseudo-sovereign, because they are not themselves determining their own values.
Correct.
They yeah. are, in fact, just adopting the achievement society values. They are not able to set their own ends. So as much as Gary Vee is a yeah. self-starter and self-motivated and all that, he's doing extremely conventional and system-reproducing kinds of things. And I think what you're saying about the need, actually trying to achieve something like a truer or fuller individuality has precisely to do with being able to set your own ends and to set your own values, which is, it's a different model of social change, and it has to do with cultural change and change of values and coming up with new values. I think that is absolutely necessary. Precisely for the reason that, you know, as we've been saying this entire conversation, political economy is not everything, right? Cultural values actually are part of the system, either by way of transforming it or maintaining it or collapsing it and so forth. So, okay, those are, yeah, concluding thoughts on my part.
Great. Yeah. No, I do feel like I have a clearer grasp on sort of what's going on, you know? I don't think what's going on out there is just random and chaos. I mean, I think there is a shape to it about what's going on. And I do think we're underestimating the degree to which the elites are scrambling and in panic. And actually, regular people are starting to feel maybe a little bit more relaxed, maybe a little bit more calm. You know, because the outburst of negativity, I think, is actually extremely relieving for a lot of people. And Hans' statement about the oppressive feeling of excessive positivity and stifling positivity is something I recognized immediately when he was talking about it. You know. Anyway. Super fun talk.
Yeah.
Continue this. Appreciate your time. Appreciate your thoughtfulness on all this. So it was really nice talking to you, Fred.
Absolutely, Teen. I also feel like I've clarified a few things in my head. I mean, and this discussion of Hans' work has been particularly useful. I do think I have a better grasp on what he's talking about, as well as his own position. So, yeah, let's do be in touch, and please let me know when we can expect to see this the pod out.
Cool. All right, man.
All right.
Okay. See you.
Okay. Have a great night.